Good morning, DFW. Sean and RJ here, 105 through the Fan, 9 o'clock hour. It means it's fist pump time here. I'm RJ Choppy. He's Bobby Belt, Peyton, and Caitlin. Peyton and Caitlin, it rhymes. Alongside, Sean is out till he's back Monday after his little snip snip.
What?
Yeah.
He's what? Out?
He is.
Is that the story?
Yeah.
That's
suspension, right? Absolutely.
I got you. So he's going to miss our Firehouse Tour tomorrow.
He is going to miss the Firehouse Tour. We are at Denton Firehouse number 3, 1401 Underwood in Denton tomorrow. We got our cool insulated cooler bags we're giving away. We got some food, Palmer's Hot Chicken, Catfish, and Shrimp. We'll be out there as well. So head on out. Join us for Firehouse Tour 2024.
We'll have Eric Chiafalo joining us.
That's right.
So you can come up. You can get some G-bag flags. Say hey to Eric. It'll be a great time. Come out to Denton. Come see us. We'll anything you want to talk to us about? Anything at all?
Anything at all.
Wink, wink. We'll
talk
chat.
Anything. We will talk right now with John Morosi. You can see and hear John Morosi on SiriusXM and the Major League MLB Network. Hosted a new podcast from SiriusXM and the National Baseball Hall of Fame called The Road to Cooperstown, which, Bobby, if you've been to Cooperstown, it's awesome. Tells the stories of the all-time great players who are enshrined in the Hall of Fame. And John spoke at length with Rangers Hall of Famer Adrian Beltre on a recent episode, which we heard on the SiriusXM app or anywhere you listen to your podcast. Morning, John. How was that conversation with Adrian Beltre?
RJ and Bobby, first of all, thanks for having me on the show. It was outstanding. And Adrian, as you both know, is first class, a true gentleman, and really was introspective about our conversation and his own career. And he talked about when he signed with the Mariners, of course, before he became a Ranger, how heartbreaking it was for him to leave the Dodgers, how he didn't sleep well for a long time because he felt like he had made a mistake leaving the Dodgers and going to Seattle, and how much he struggled that first year with the pressure of the contract. And you could really tell that as he spoke about his journey, Dodgers, Mariners, the one year in Boston, that it really all led to the time in Texas, and that by the time he arrived to the Rangers, he had been through so much physically, mentally in the game that Texas really got the best of him, and it was the best version of him. And I think that was a very interesting thing to hear about his journey, and certainly how much he loved playing with Elvis, how much he loved competing against Felix Hernandez, a lot of really unique stories. And he also talked about the 2011 World Series and how he still feels, even all these years later, he talked about how he still feels responsible for the way in which David Freese was pitched, the way that the outfield was positioned. He felt in his own mind that he wanted to be more aware in that moment, and certainly we could all understand what it was like in St. Louis that night. It was just a really honest conversation from Adrian about so many things in his career.
You know, John, we love Adrian Beltre here, obviously, in the Metroplex. He's one of the more beloved figures in the history of the Rangers. We've had this discussion on the show before about the idea of 30 years from now, people who never saw him play, if they look back at Adrian Beltre, they may look at his numbers and go like, that guy just looks like a compiler. Look at this. He finished top three in the MVP twice in 20 years. He made 4 All-Star games. That doesn't sound like a Hall of Famer to me. If 30 years from now, somebody's asking what made Adrian Beltre so great, these are just, you know, stat padding. How would you describe Adrian Beltre's legacy and career and why he is a Hall of Famer?
Yeah, it's a great question. I would answer probably the headlines would be as follows. Number one, I don't care how you compiled or accrued 3,000 hits. 3,000 hits is 3,000 hits. And that is a unique total among third basemen, especially when you add in 477 home runs. It's just these numbers, especially the position that he played, are legendary. So first of all, the numbers say that he belongs, and certainly the fact that he got in on his first ballot says plenty about that. The other parts are, and Ron Renneke, who managed him in the minor leagues and has been a longtime major league manager and really a trusted evaluator, he said this, that Adrian Beltre handled the slow roller at third base better than anybody he'd ever seen in his lifetime in baseball. And Ron Renneke is not someone who is given to hyperbole. He's been around the game for a long, long time. And when Ron says that he's never seen anybody better, it means there's never been anybody better at that particular play, which, as we know, is a very important part of playing third base. And the other piece is what a respected teammate he is. And that is an all-encompassing description because it involves the way that he related to his teammates. And it's interesting to hear, and I've actually talked with both Michael Young and Adrian about this story. And you both know very well the circumstances when Adrian came over. It was after the 2010 World Series. There were questions about Michael Young's defense at third base and what his role was going to be and how many at-bats Michael was going to get. Was he going to get traded? So it was a very delicate time because the Rangers were coming off their first ever World Series, and Michael Young was in so many ways the face of the team and so beloved in the market. And here comes Beltre to effectively take his job. And it could have been a very, very awkward time because there was, of course, a lot of tension between Michael and John Daniels at the time, as you both know very well. Mm-hmm. And Michael and Adrian were both so professional that all of that tension floated away and they made it back to the World Series that year. And I just think that doesn't happen without Adrian being someone of such high integrity with the way that he handled it. Plus, as you both know, how often he played hurt, especially later in his career. Hamstrings, any issue at all. He was grinding through it, playing on one leg. And I just think that when you talk to people, which I like to do whenever it's about Hall of Famers or awards, talk to the people who wear the uniform, who are in the dugouts, and you say, hey, what do you got on Beltre? And that almost universally, it is instant acclaim and praise and respect for the person and the competitor above even what the numbers are.
Yeah, it really is. John Morosi joining us here on 105.3 The Fan. All right, the playoffs. I mean, I love the baseball playoffs. I think they've had a really good one so far. I know the TV ratings have been doing pretty well so far this postseason. The one thing that stands out, and it's trended like this for years, and I get a lot of texts from guys who are former pitchers in the league or who I follow on social media, and they can't get over just the fact that none of these guys are going deep into games. How many guys are you talking to that are former players, the pitchers especially, maddening, that find it so maddening the way bullpens are used in the playoffs today?
Yeah, it is a common refrain. I hear it from people that have been around the game for a while as well. And to put a specific number on it, if you lined up all of the starts so far in the postseason this year, 64 games, and if you plotted out how long the starting pitcher went all those games, so define the median number, what is the most middle and common length of a start, it's 4 2/3 innings. That is the middle, that is the median start in the playoffs right now is 4 2/3 innings. And it's for two reasons. Number one, because starting pitchers now are not trained for the distance running, they're trained for the sprint. Right. And basically they tell you, throw it as hard as you can for as long as you can, and then when you're spent, we've got six or seven guys who are all throwing a billion miles an hour ready to come out of the pen. So I think it's a combination, and we can talk about what came first, but starting pitchers are told to generate swings and misses. You got to go max effort earlier in the game. It's almost like they're taking a relief pitching mentality out from the first pitch of the game. And that's how they're trained. That, I think, is one of the reasons why we see a lot of injuries. But that is the reality of the game right now. And then in the bullpen, it's a similar thing. A lot of the analytics say, and by the way, they've got real-time analytics coming in saying, okay, his stride length is shortening, or his extension is not what it was in the first inning, which tells you he's getting fatigued. And when this guy gets fatigued, you better get him out of here now because he's likely to hang a slider, and then we're down 3-0. And the idea is we want to get him out of the game before he hangs the curveball or hangs the slider. And then there's just so much talent in the bullpens that's rested and ready to go. So I get it. It's frustrating. The notion of the Roy Halladay, Chris Carpenter game from 2011, we just don't see it anymore. And on some level, it's a shame, but this is very much numerically based. And these decisions are made often not by the managers, and they're made at times like right now at a little after 9:10 in the morning about what they're going to do with their pitching decisions at night.
John Morosi joining us here on Sean and RJ on 105.3 The Fan. John, it looks like now after last night we're heading for a Dodgers, Yankees, Judge, Ohtani type of World Series setup here. When you look at the moves baseball's made and the changes baseball's made over the last, you know, almost 2 years, and the popularity that's come with that, and the popularity of the World Baseball Classic, you know, within the last couple of years, and this culmination here, is this about as positive a peak run of growth, if the MLB does get this matchup that they want, is this about as positive a 2 year stretch of growth as MLB's had since, you know, the Maguire Sosa home run chase?
You know, that's a great observation, and I think it's true. The WBC really generated a lot of positive momentum. I think the pitch timer has too. For all of us that have watched games and gone to games in person since the pitch timers come around, it's a better product. And postseason baseball, it becomes a more entertaining product because with the pitch timer, you've got more action per minute spent. Mm-hmm. And now you've also got, to your point, superstars whose stories that we know well, Otani, Judge, Soto, others that are certainly of this high profile, Mookie Betts, Freddie Freeman. You know, if the Yankees and Dodgers meet, you're going to have a lot of future Hall of Famers involved in that series. And we tend to, when you look back historically, you reflect on some of the great World Series, and you even go with the Braves, Twins, for example, back in 91. There's a lot of Hall of Famers that were involved in that World Series. And that tends to elevate the profile of those games, both in real time, but even more so in retrospect. And I think that's what we're headed for if, again, it becomes Yankees-Dodgers. And I think in general there's always been this conversation around, well, how much are superstars marketed in baseball in comparison to other sports? And I've always said there's inherent challenges because of the schedule. Aaron Judge is not going to do an interview with GQ and ESPN and Turner and MLB Network every single day because he's got a game every single day. He's got a lot of work right to do. We got 162, 10 times as many games as you got in the NFL. And we do it every year. So there's just a lot of demands on the players' times to take that profile and put it, whether it's in social media or more traditional media. But I think that the reality is Aaron Judge with the homers that he hits and the profile that he has, captain of the Yankees, Shohei Ohtani doing things that no one has ever done, Mookie Betts, who is as classy of an ambassador as we've got for the sport. If you can't watch these games and appreciate their athleticism, then I'm not sure what I can do for you.
Right.
There's so much ability out there, and the people involved are really outstanding people. Dave Roberts, Aaron Boone, and the other managers involved right now as well. It's a great story for the game, and I'm really having a lot of fun just watching and appreciating what we're seeing right now in baseball.
I guess the only downside is the series could be over tomorrow. They could be wrapped up tomorrow. We have to wait a whole week for the World Series. John, real quick, how much do these TV deals impact what teams like the Rangers want to do in the offseason and what their ability is to do things?
You know, it's a great question, and I think it's certainly an element of the unknown. And we saw it last year with the Rangers even coming off a World Series. Whether it's any individual citizen buying a house or buying a car, or whether it's the Rangers making a bid on Juan Soto or Anthony Santander or not, when there's uncertainty about what the budget's going to be, it stifles activity. And I think that's where a lot of teams find themselves. And now it's not just the Rangers; it's a larger swath of teams. And I'll say this as we close: we have been familiar with off seasons where a lot of us are waiting around for teams to act because of either uncertainty with revenues, which is what's happening right now, or the one big free agent that is sort of dominating everything. We've got that with Juan Soto. This could be one of those winters that is a bit of a hurry up and wait kind of a vibe, just because everybody's waiting to know what their budget's going to be, and everybody wants to know where Juan Soto is going to play.
John, this is great. Love having you on, man. Thank you so much.
Appreciate the conversation. Enjoy the playoffs, my friend. Thanks so much.
Viewers from the shotgun on first down, turns, hands it to Weisman. Cuts up the middle, 40, 35. Trey still on his feet. Outside, here goes Weisner. Say goodnight to this one. Trey Weisner in the end zone for the touchdown. How's that to make up for a fumble? 43 yards on a big rumble.
That is the voice of the great Craig Way on 105.3 The Fan. He is joining us here right now. You can hear that game, Texas and Georgia, Saturday night on our sister station, 1080 KRL. D, they have crosstalk with the KMC Masterpiece coming up in about 20 minutes. Good morning, Craig. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, good morning. Great to be on with you guys again.
I know the Longhorns have played Mississippi State already and obviously Oklahoma. But this is different, right? Does this feel like, hey, like this is the real welcome to the conference kind of moment here with Georgia coming to town?
Yeah, I think so. And you know what adds to the mania and the excitement is the fact you got the F1 race down here as well. So this town's cooking right now, and folks are pretty excited about it. But from a football perspective, yes. And understanding that Georgia definitely will be the best team they face this year. Carson Beck will be the best quarterback they face to this point this year. And the Georgia defense will be the best defense they face this year. Although Oklahoma's defense is a good defense, the Longhorns just executed really well against it after the first quarter once they got warmed up and going. But this will be the best total team they have faced this season without question.
Craig, you know, we got the return of Quinn Ewers against Oklahoma and looked a little off at times. Do you think that was an issue of just a flat game or what Oklahoma was doing, or was that knocking off the rust? And if it was knocking off the rust, how important was it for him to get into that game against Oklahoma so that he'd be sharper and ready to play in this big game against Georgia?
Yeah, I think it was largely the rust factor a little bit. I mean, he did practice even the week right after he got injured, suffered the oblique, and in the walk up to Mississippi State, he did practice limited. The bye week, he practiced pretty much regularly. And then obviously the OU week, he practiced regularly. But they had to monitor the oblique. And his throwing was cut down a little bit during all of that time. So it wasn't like complete normal practice schedule for him. So I do think he was a little bit rusty on that. I asked Sark about that last night on the coach's show, and he was saying there were a couple of things, they had a couple of protection breakdowns early, and they had a couple of the Oklahoma showed him a couple of different reads early. So there was an adjustment phase, no question about it. Quinn, by his own admission, said so, told us in the post game, and then during the media availability this week, he said, yeah, I was glad I had teammates around me to help everything get shaken off and get me back on my game, which he did after that first quarter.
Craig, do games like this kind of scary a little bit? Like, Georgia's pretty desperate, right? They know they can't afford a second loss. I mean, Texas doesn't have a loss. They, you know, and you don't want to, you know, say that you can lose a game, but in the 12-team playoff, I mean, a one-loss SEC team is still going to make it. Like, is this kind of a desperation spot for Georgia that should scare a Longhorn fan a little bit?
Well, I think what should give them pause is just knowing how good this team is coming in. There is that also with regard to the fact that they can ill afford to have another loss. And I'll tell you this, too. Think about this for a minute, fellas. This weekend between Alabama, Tennessee, and Georgia, think those three, Alabama, Tennessee, and Georgia, at least one is going to have two conference losses, and maybe two will have two conference losses if Texas wins. And that would have been probably unfathomable for folks to consider going into the start of the season that just passed the midway point, that Alabama or Tennessee, one of those two is definitely going to have two SEC losses, and maybe even Georgia. So it's a different kind of college football season, especially with the expanded 12-team playoff. But even within the boundaries of the SEC, it's a different kind of look.
Craig Way joining us here on 105 Through the Fan. Okay, Craig, so if you're looking for a flaw for Texas, which Texas has been, remarkably consistent and pretty even across the board, especially compared relatively to the rest of college football right now. Right now, I know Sark has honed in on the turnover margin's not acceptable, and they've had some issues with some turnovers. Is this a game where, hey, if you don't clean it up, you've had a few weeks, if you don't clean it up against Georgia, this is the week that it might burn you?
Yep, spot on. He has said, and what we normally say, it's almost kind of become a running joke between us when I ask him about what turns the game, what are the keys to the game, all of those kinds of phrases, and he'll always say the ball, because meaning taking care of it and taking it away a little bit. And you look at Georgia, Georgia's a minus one in the turnover. They haven't been getting takeaways. And so, Carson Beck has had a good season to this point. It's not a spectacular Heisman-based season, but he's had a good season. But he's thrown five interceptions, and some have come on tip passes and things like that. Well, Georgia hasn't been able to even it up on the other side nearly as much or get more. That's why they're a minus one in the turnover. Well, the Longhorns are a plus four, which is respectable, but it's not national championship caliber. So, yes, getting and staying away from turnovers, I think, is the crucial thing in a game like this.
Craig, how big has it been for Texas just getting these two young contributors in Colin Simmons and Anthony Hill Jr., who – I'm going to be a little biased here as a Longhorns fan. I'm going to start the push for Anthony Hill Jr. for the Bednarik is what I'm going to do. Ooh. But when you look at what you've gotten out of Anthony Hill and what you've gotten out of Colin Simmons, just how big has it been to see those young players click and you know, find their spot so quickly?
Yeah, and Metroplex kids, right?
Hell, you know? Yeah.
Absolutely, with the Simmons from Duncanville and Hill from Denton Ryan. We've seen the steady progression of Anthony Hill from last year, where it was kind of more like Colin, which it was a lot of see ball, get ball. It was that kind of thing. And so there was a lot of, just learning it and trying to learn the position better. And he said that by his own admission too, that he needed to improve. Colin, came in and kind of quietly went through the fall camp. We didn't hear his name discussed a lot, and then it just started with being unleashed. And I called both of his state championship games the last 2 years for television and saw the beast that he was at the high school level. And I remember thinking, how long does it take for his game to translate and transition into the collegiate level at a high level? And we're just starting to see the edge of this now, the way he's going, and he's getting better every day. So they've both been big additions, and the growth of Anthony Hill is a big part of it.
Talk with Craig Way here on the D&M Leasing Hotline. Okay, Craig, so when one of the things we saw, not only just with the rust with Quinn Ewers, was when he was under pressure, that was a little bit of a problem. When he was able to kind of comfortably stand back and read the defense and go through his progressions, everything was really solid. But the pressure was kind of rattling him a little bit the other day. Is that a big factor in this one for you, is just the idea of being able to protect Quinn Ewers with what is, widely considered one of the better offensive lines in college football?
Well, it's always important. And, even coming out of the Oklahoma game, I would still say the number one overall position strength of the Longhorns is the offensive front. They have played largely really, really solid. But early on, in the Oklahoma game, there were a couple of protection mistakes made, and it wasn't just with the offensive front. It was also backs picking up blitzers, and it was also receivers not being able to get off of the coverage at the line, things like that. That all adjusted. And I'll tell you another thing that helped adjust it, too. The running game, because Oklahoma was, playing a lot of cloud coverage, and Oklahoma was laying way off of it for a while and dropping deep. And so Texas, which likes to go with 11 personnel, which likes to have a back and three wide outs and one tight end, and the tight end is important in Gunnar Helm, they started being able to run the football out of that formation a lot more. And Jaden Blue and Trey Wisner, you had the highlight from there from the DeSoto kid, and he had a touchdown there. That was a big part of it as well. And if they're able to run the ball like that, like they did after the first quarter against Oklahoma, they had a big second quarter running the football against the Sooners. If they're able to do those kinds of things, it's going to make the passing game better. And obviously it's going to make the offensive line much more effective against that Georgia front.
Craig, is this a Georgia front, though, that is like this? They're still the wall against the run. They're just a really solid run defense still.
Well, they're good. They're fourth in the SEC against the run. I think 43rd, front end of the middle of the pack, you might say, in the nation against the run. Pass defense is about the same, but their total defense and their scoring defense has been good. And I think the Longhorns are going to have to be patient. Patient with the run, and going to have to be patient with the offense, because I don't know that they're going to have a lot of big strikes like they've had against some other teams this year. In fact, I'm relatively certain that's not going to happen. So they may be able to get one or maybe two, but this isn't going to be a game like some of the other ones they've had where they've been able to just take deep shot after deep shot because it's there. Because a lot of times it won't be there, and they're just going to have to be patient with the offense to do it. I think they can move the ball on Georgia, especially with their offensive line, but it's going to require a little more patience than against most of the other opponents they've seen this year.
The voice of the Longhorns, Craig Way, joining us here on 105 The Fan. Craig, last one for you here. You know, when you, we've mentioned it already here, in the new era of the CFP and the expanded CFP, going undefeated is not nearly as important as it once was. Being the number one ranked team in the country isn't nearly as important as it once was. But for Texas specifically, coming to the, into the SEC and trying to establish their presence there, do you think it's important to people within this program as a top goal of, man, we really want to go undefeated and hold on to that number one the entire year?
Yeah, I think there's some to that, but I think you make a great point that it's not it's not as critical as it once was. I mean, the two things that really struck me about this college football season in this 12-team playoff debut season. One, that that we've never talked about G5 programs as much as we're talking about them now. I mean, how much conversation is everybody having about Army and Navy and Boise State and things like that? That's one. The other thing is that the AP poll just seems more inconsequential than it ever has been, because we know the College Football Playoff Committee is going to do their own thing, although they don't start until November. So, and we also know the way the rules are set up. If you win your conference championship in a Power Four league, you get a bye in the first round. That, I think, is the biggest directive for what Sark wants with this program. Yes, win the SEC and get that first round bye, whether you've got one loss or no losses. If you win the SEC, you're getting a first round bye for that playoff. So I think that's probably among those who are closest to the program the most important part.
Hey, Craig, real quick, we're up against it. When they get to the second round, so the first four teams with the bye, will they place them in bowl games? Are they preset, or are they going to be kind of closest to the higher seed?
Yeah, it's going to be based on what the other teams in the playoff and where the committee would say. So I would say if Texas gets a bye,
Sugar Bowl,
look for them to be either in Atlanta for the Peach or New Orleans for the Sugar. Probably one of those two. And the math does suggest the possibility they could play in Atlanta three times in 5 weeks. If it was the SEC championship, the Peach Bowl, and if they make it all the way to the national championship, that is a possibility.
All right. Very good. It'd be we had to come up with a nickname for that. Like Kentucky calls it Catlanta. We're going to find a nickname for that one. Hey, Craig, thank you so much. Enjoy the call this weekend.
Thanks, fellas. Great to be on with you.
Craig Way, voice of the Longhorns here on 105. Good morning, DFW. It's Sean and RJ here on 105.3 The Fan, and my boys are here.
What's up, man? RJ?
What's happening?
My boy.
I'm really glad you started talking, because since I'm sitting in this spot, I was really close to going, KNC Masterpiece back here.
I hate doing this.
That's, you know what? That's interesting, because Dawson never sits in that seat when you're not around. Yeah. He always stays over there. Maybe it's because he would feel like he'd do the
Pure
same thing.
Pure gold as always.
Yeah.
Pure gold as always.
It's easy if you can get your stuff set up ahead of time.
It is. I guess, yeah, it is easier. There's no doubt about that.
On a scale of 1 to 10, how good do you think the show's been today?
Oh, 4. No.
Oh, no.
I don't know. What do you think? It's been
five.
Fun.
Five.
Five? Yeah. Five and a half?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. We strive. At least I do. I'm a C student.
Sure.
C's get degrees.
I have a question.
I just want to be in the top three.
I haven't, led crosstalk in a while because I'm not here much.
You're due.
Yeah. Was the company happy with what you said on the Dan Patrick show?
Yeah, I got good feedback, positive feedback on that one. Yeah, they thought I did a good job.
And by the company, do you mean the Dallas Cowboys Football Club, Mike?
Yeah.
Multiple.
The CRN, the Dallas Cowboys
multiple
Radio
companies
Network.
Yeah,
Vince McMahon came down and had a conversation with him.
Oh, dear.
I watched it. And I really enjoyed it. I thought you did a great job. You. I was like, man, Choppy sounds better than he does on his show right now.
Yeah, it's.
Is that why you tuned out of our second segment? Yeah, you were watching it live?
I was very interested in that. I love Dan Patrick. Like, he's at the top of the list for me.
I'm a much better guest than I am a host. I'm much better when I'm joining other people's shows.
Such a weird thing to say on your radio program.
I'm a much better guest than somebody actually does this.
It's like the questions Dan Patrick asked were great questions as always.
Yeah,
you know, that's what he does.
What a shock!
And then and I was like, man, all right, Toppy's gonna. And then you answered it right. And I was like, man, that was a really good answer. So nice work, man.
I had the toots of nervousness the entire time.
I bet.
What's that?
Yeah,
did you say the toots of nervousness?
Yeah, that's where you get nervous.
I liked it because you're very pro Jerry Jones. Jones.
Yeah, it was. You know, we put him at number one in our power rankings yesterday.
Hell yeah. And owners are just people.
Owners?
That was the end of the sentence.
Yeah. Well, he said they put him number one in the power rankings.
Oh, like, the team. No, oh, the Cowboys. The team. Okay, yeah, the Cowboys. Gotcha. I mean, they're the best.
To be specific, we put the 1995 Cowboys number one in our power rankings.
Oh.
Yeah.
Head of 92, eh?
We're trying to. We're just trying to. Well, okay. That. He had, 95 was his.
Yeah.
92, 93.
That's
95 was his.
Mm-hmm.
Can I ask you something? That was Barry's. He told us on Friday. He said, don't forget about how important Barry Switzer was.
Have you ever heard of a player in 1995 crediting Barry Switzer with anything? I've never. I'm being honest. When you watch the Great Wall of Dallas, if you watch like the Troy Aikman special, the Emmitt Smith special, Michael Irvin's, whatever it is, whenever you watch this, like I have not heard a player yet, whether it's Tony Casillas, Chad Henning, Darren Woodson. I've not heard a player yet from 1995 credit Barry Switzer with anything.
No.
Casillas did play for Switzer in college, right?
He did.
There, you'll usually get the opposite. You will have players publicly say, like, we had to run things ourselves,
like,
basically.
Do it on our own. We were we had to be, like, the leader and the head coach because we literally had nobody, which, in a way, I guess Jerry Jones did win this battle when he said, I could get 500 different people. Yeah. To coach this team to a championship, he actually did. He got a guy who stood there with a gun, I guess, in the plane.
That was only in the airport. It wasn't on the field.
And actually just stand there on the sideline, and they did win.
He forgot. He forgot it was there.
Now we have to take our shoes off at the airport because of Barry Switzer.
Jerry won one on his own. He proved that I don't even need a coach with Jimmy Johnson's players.
Dude, would you kind of want to hear him interview himself then?
Jerry?
Yeah.
In a way, I think he does, because there's times where we ask questions and
he just answers whatever.
It has nothing to do with what we just said. And that's like when you said you needed to clarify.
Yeah.
Like,
don't tell me what I'm saying.
Yeah, it's like 50% of the time, Jerry, us, the people listening, we have to try to figure out what you said because it doesn't make much sense to us.
Oh, from the 972, not going to lie, Choppy as a guest on Sunday nights is awesome with Jody Mack.
Hey, yeah, whoa, Jody Mack.
Are you? How many guest things are you doing,
Jody?
Is this what you? Are you the? Hey. Are you
I like the, Jody.
Hey, RJ. I'll go. Yeah, I do more than I probably should say yes to.
It is not like that. Hey, let's hear your Jody Mack real quick. What was it?
Hey, how's that guy still have a job?
I like Jody Mack. I'm not gonna say. I love
Jody Mack. Hey, RJ. You know, you guys have come a long way from Gary Hogeboom. Things aren't so bad.
That's a really good.
That
impression.
Actually is a really
That's
good.
A really good That's a really good. What's coming up with the show? Really,
oh man, we start the show today with Puck Around and Find Out
All
how
right.
the Stars regain home ice advantage and why it's so important to win tonight. And
no,
even
it's
though
not.
Kevin thinks it's not. And then we don't have Mickey tomorrow. But we'll have him today.
What?
With a legendary story about the Grandmama commercials. So we'll talk about
Larry Johnson?
Yeah, we're going to talk about that at 11
with
o'clock.
Mickey
today.
Spagnuolo?
No, it's after Mickey. It'll
they'll
be after
all
Mickey.
Happen in the same segment. Yeah. They'll probably be separated, but we'll see.
And don't forget our friend Kyle Yeomans. We moved him to Thursdays. So if you want to hear, he's done some phenomenal work for us. We really appreciate him. Great dude. So we'll have him again today at 1 o'clock.
We figured Seinfeld was good enough for Thursdays.
Yeah.
Kyle is good enough for Thursdays.
Absolutely. I can totally see that.
Isn't it? Isn't it kind of
to follow Friends, right?
I thought Seinfeld did a bad job of opening up Game 3. Did you guys see the start of Game 3 last night?
Yes.
Did he throw the first pitch?
Mets and Dodgers. No, they had him.
The start of it. I was.
They had him do like the minute of Dodger fans are pretty. We're not pretty. Like you know, it just.
Well,
I'm
a Dodger fan, so
I'm a fan of Seinfeld. I do like the show. Still like the show, but I felt like, and he did his job. He read the script, and he probably wrote it right because he is a comedian writer. Is I just felt like it didn't get me pumped up for the game.
Okay.
So I felt like, it's Seinfeld. He's a Mets fan, but I didn't feel like it got me pumped up for Game 3.
I heard him say, he was talking on maybe the Smartless podcast, and he was talking about when he became a Mets fan. And he said he showed up at the field, and he saw it was kind of wacky, kind of zany. There's this thing on the, you know, he said, you know, get Mr. Met on the field. And he said, once I saw that, I was like, this is my people. He said the Yankees weren't my people, but that fit the way I think. And Mike, you played there, so how different is that environment than it is from like the Yankees?
So there's way more Yankee fans than Mets fans. I would say three times the amount. Would you say that, Choppy? I mean, you grew up there. I'd say three times the amount of Yankee fans to Mets fans. So you're the underdog. You are what they kind of consider Mets and Jets, Giants and Yankees. And Knicks go into the Yankees, the Nets go into the Mets and the Jets. Is like you're the hard workers of the community. You're the Yankee. It's kind of the wine and cheese kind of deal. Would you say that? Yeah. But there are plenty of Yankee fans who are not
plumbers.
Yeah, there's plenty of those. But that's the way that it feels like. Mm-hmm. You're a common person if you're rooting for the Mets, Jets, and Nets.
Okay,
why
you are more of the. The high brow, are the educated,
Hotel
we are
Eden
the best
people.
Of the best if we are Yankees, Giants, and Knicks.
So that feels, I hadn't noticed it before, but that alone feels pretty demeaning. Like, no, you go into the subcategory to the point where we're only going to give you a letter that's different from the other team.
Right.
I hadn't realized, it's just all Mets, Jets, and Nets.
Wow.
That's very sad. It's like, you get a letter. You don't get
a
team name.
That's super weird.
Like, Long Island is more like Mets and Jets and like Manhattan and like, the boroughs are maybe more Yankees and
it would
Giants.
Be really cool as we've grown here. And I don't know if we care that much about sports. I know if you're listening right now, you care about sports in the Metroplex. We are growing to the ability, how spread out we are. I think we have grown to the ability. Jerry Jones would never let it happen. And he's going to, on his deathbed, tell his kids, never in a million years will he even let a team go to Oklahoma City or San Antonio. Like, do not ever allow that to happen. But it is interesting that I think we have grown enough that we could be a Mets Yankees or we could be a Giants Jets type of thing.
Yeah,
but
we could.
But there's no way the Jones family, led by Jerry, even when he dies, will not let his kids. There'll be something signed in his will. You will not allow this to ever happen.
And,
like
and
San Antonio, which could have 100,000 every game, he will not allow San Antonio to have a team.
Even like baseball, the A's, one of the main reasons they moved to Vegas is because they had an opportunity to go to like San Jose. But the Giants own the territory.
Yeah, the Giants are pumped that there's no more Oakland A's because they probably pick up 30% of their fans.
Probably.
Let's just say 30 or 40 stick with it no matter what. And then there's 30 or 40% that say, I'm quitting baseball.
What?
No, the Giants own San Jose and Oakland the A's had to leave Oakland because the Crips own Oakland is why. They own
well, and the thing which would have been weird is what if Oakland would have built a stadium near where the San Francisco 49ers play?
Candlestick.
Well, not Candlestick. That's where, but you understand what I'm saying? Oh, then you'd have the San Francisco 49ers playing right next to the Oakland A's.
Oh, yeah.
That would
but
be
the
weird.
San Francisco Giants, I think, are able to dictate you can't play
there.
Where San Francisco 49ers play. So if they were even trying to get outside of Oakland to play in a better area where there's more money, less homelessness.
We could do it here. I mean, there's no doubt. Like Fort Worth, like you move build a team out in Fort Worth. Like,
I'd agree with that.
Or Frisco.
Or Frisco. You could do it. There's enough.
But I get why Ray Davis. I get why.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I say Mark Cuban. I know he doesn't own the team anymore. Who owns the team?
The Adelsons.
Yeah, they would not allow Adelsons. For the New Orleans Pelicans to move to Frisco. You know, they just, and I get why they wouldn't.
Sure, absolutely. All right.
Where can people see you tomorrow, by the way, Chop?
We are at the Firehouse. Firehouse number 3.
In Denton,
1401 Underwood. We'll have those insulated coolers and G-Bag Nation flags.
All right.
Palmer's hot.
And Sean's coconuts are on fire right now.
Coconuts. Yes, they are. Palmer's hot chicken, catfish, and shrimp will be there. And Sean's coconuts are on fire. Oh, I haven't had one.
Courtesy of Jerry.
He had the snip snip. He went to Chia Follow snip snip guy.
Oh.
Yeah. And now no more kids for him. All right. Whatever this show is called, KSC Masterpiece coming up next.
What?
Fan. What? I almost called you the G-Bag Nation.
Oh, my God. Let's go.